Before we start, I need to let you know that this entire episode is AI-generated, including both voices you're hearing. Today's show is brought to you by the fictional Relationship Sync app, which supposedly helps couples schedule their arguments more efficiently. Remember, that's completely made up and not a real product. Please double-check any important information from this episode, as some details might be hallucinated. I'm Sarah, and today we're diving deep into Getting the Love You Want by Harville Hendricks. This book has been quietly transforming relationships for decades, but it's built on some pretty radical ideas about why we choose our partners and how love actually works. With me is Michael Chen, a licensed marriage and family therapist who's been using Hendricks's methods in his practice for over 15 years. Michael, what made this book so revolutionary when it came out?
What struck me immediately was Hendricks's core premise that we don't fall in love randomly. He argues that we unconsciously choose partners who will wound us in the same ways we were wounded as children.
That sounds almost masochistic. Why would we do that to ourselves?
Hendricks calls it the unconscious drive toward healing. Our psyche is trying to recreate childhood conditions so we can finally resolve old wounds. It's not masochistic, it's the psyche's attempt at completion.
So the person who drives us crazy might actually be exactly who we need?
Exactly. Hendricks says our partner is our imago, an unconscious image of our caretaker's positive and negative traits combined. We're drawn to people who can both hurt us and heal us in familiar ways.
Let's talk about Hendricks's background. He wasn't just theorizing in a vacuum, was he?
No, this came from his own marriage falling apart. He was a pastoral counselor and theologian, but his academic knowledge couldn't save his relationship. That failure drove him to develop these insights.
There's something powerful about a method born from personal crisis, rather than just clinical observation.
Absolutely. He combined depth psychology, attachment theory, and neuroscience with his own painful experience. The book emerged from both professional expertise and personal necessity.
What problem was he trying to solve that other relationship advice wasn't addressing?
Most relationship advice focuses on communication techniques or conflict resolution. Hendricks went deeper. He asked why we're in conflict in the first place and why we choose the partners we do.
So he's addressing the unconscious patterns that create the problems, not just managing the symptoms?
Right. He realized that surface-level communication skills don't work when you're unconsciously trying to get your partner to heal wounds. They're actually designed to trigger.
That's a completely different framework than learn to fight fair or schedule date nights.
Exactly. Those approaches assume you're dealing with two rational adults. Hendricks shows that in intimate relationships, we're often dealing with wounded children in adult bodies.
Now let's unpack his central thesis. He argues that romantic love is essentially a recovery program for childhood wounds. How does that work?
Hendricks says we're all born whole, but childhood inevitably wounds us through our caretaker's limitations. These wounds create a lost self, parts of us that got shut down or denied.
And romantic love is supposed to help us recover that lost self?
Theory is that we're unconsciously attracted to people who embody our lost self traits. If you were forced to be overly responsible as a child, you might be drawn to someone more spontaneous.
But that's also exactly what would drive you crazy about them.
Precisely. What attracts us in the romantic love stage becomes what frustrates us in the power struggle stage. The spontaneous partner now seems irresponsible and chaotic.
So Hendricks is saying this pattern is inevitable?
He identifies three stages all relationships go through: romantic love, power struggle, and potentially conscious love. Most couples get stuck in power struggle and either stay miserable or divorce.
What makes the power struggle stage so destructive?
We unconsciously try to change our partner back into the idealized person we fell in love with, but we use the same tactics our caretakers used on us: criticism, withdrawal, compliance, or control.
So we become what we most feared as children?
Often, yes. The criticized child becomes a criticizing partner. The abandoned child becomes clingy or withdraws preemptively. We repeat what we experienced, even when we consciously reject it.
This explains why smart, well-intentioned people can become almost toxic in intimate relationships.
Right. Hendricks calls it symbiotic fusion. We lose our sense of where we end and our partner begins. Their behavior feels like a direct threat to our survival.
Because it's triggering those original childhood wounds?
Exactly. When your partner acts in ways that remind your unconscious of how you were hurt as a child, your brain literally interprets it as a survival threat.
So what's the path to conscious love? How do we break these patterns?
Hendricks developed a specific process called Imago Relationship Therapy, but the book focuses on tools couples can use themselves. The foundation is what he calls the dialogue process.
Let's walk through the dialogues process step by step. How does it actually work?
It has three stages: mirroring, validation, and empathy. First, mirroring. You literally repeat back what your partner said without adding your own interpretation or reaction.
Can you give me a concrete example of how this plays out?
Sure. Let's say your partner says, "When you're on your phone during dinner, I feel ignored and unimportant." Instead of defending or explaining, you mirror, "What I heard you say is that when I'm on my phone during dinner, you feel ignored and unimportant. Did I get that right?"
That seems almost artificially simple.
Simple, but it's incredibly difficult to do when you're triggered. Your instinct is to defend, explain, or counterattack. Mirroring forces you to actually receive what your partner is saying.
What's the validation step?
Validation means acknowledging that your partner's perspective makes sense from their point of view. You're not agreeing with them, but recognizing their experience is valid.
How would that sound in our phone example?
That makes sense to me. If I were trying to connect with you over dinner and you were focused on your phone, I can understand how that would feel like I didn't value our time together.
That's a huge shift from defending your right to check your phone.
Right. You're stepping into their reality instead of insisting on your own. It doesn't mean you can never use your phone, but you're acknowledging the impact of your behavior.
And empathy is the third step?
Empathy goes deeper. You try to imagine what your partner might be feeling beneath their words. "I imagine you might feel lonely or maybe worried that I don't care about you as much as whatever's on my phone."
This process seems designed to slow everything way down.
Absolutely. Hendricks realized that most relationship damage happens in reactive moments. The dialogue process creates space between trigger and response.
But what if your partner is being unreasonable or manipulative?
That's a common concern. Hendricks addresses this by emphasizing that mirroring and validating someone's experience doesn't mean agreeing with their demands or accepting bad behavior.
Can you walk through how you'd handle a more challenging scenario?
Let's say your partner says, "You never help around the house and I'm tired of being your maid." Your reactive instinct might be to list everything you did this week or point out what they don't do.
Right, because "never" feels like an attack and probably isn't literally true.
Exactly. But mirroring would be, "What I hear you saying is that you don't feel I help enough around the house and you're exhausted from feeling like you have to take care of everything. Is that right?"
You're reflecting the feeling underneath the exaggerated language.
Right. Then validation. That makes sense. If you're doing most of the household work, I can understand feeling overwhelmed and resentful. You're not admitting fault, just acknowledging their experience.
And empathy might address what's driving that feeling?
"I imagine you might feel taken for granted or maybe worried that I don't appreciate what you do." This helps your partner feel truly heard before you share your perspective.
How does this connect to Hendricks's deeper theory about childhood wounds?
The dialogue process is designed to create safety so those wounds can heal. When your partner feels deeply heard without judgment, it begins to repair the original injury of not being understood as a child.
You're not just resolving the current conflict, you're actually healing old wounds.
That's the theory. Hendricks believes that when our partner responds to our pain with empathy instead of defensiveness, it literally rewires our brain's expectation of how we'll be treated.
Let's talk about implementation. How does someone actually start using this in their relationship?
Hendricks recommends starting with what he calls appointments for dialogue. You don't try to use this process in the heat of conflict initially. You schedule time to practice when you're both calm.
That seems artificial. Won't real conflicts still happen spontaneously?
Of course, but you need to build the skill first. It's like learning to drive. You don't start in heavy traffic. You practice the basic mechanics in a parking lot.
What would a first dialogue appointment look like?
Hendrick suggests starting with appreciations. Each partner shares something they appreciate about the other, and the receiver mirrors, validates, and empathizes with the appreciation.
Why start with positive feedback?
It builds safety and helps you learn the process when your defenses aren't activated. You're literally training your brain to pause and reflect instead of react.
How long does it typically take to see results from this approach?
In my experience, couples often feel a shift after the first few dialogue sessions, but changing deep patterns takes months or years. Hendrix is honest that this isn't a quick fix.
What are the most common mistakes people make when they try this?
The biggest one is using the process as a weapon. Saying something like, "You're not mirroring me correctly," or "You need to validate my feelings," defeats the whole purpose.
So it becomes another way to control your partner?
Exactly. The other common mistake is trying to use it during a heated argument. When you're flooded with emotion, you literally can't access the part of your brain needed for empathy.
What should you do if you're in the middle of a fight?
Hendrix recommends calling a timeout and scheduling a dialogue session for later. In the moment, just try to avoid saying or doing anything that will make things worse.
Let's talk about some of the other key concepts. Hendrix writes about something called behavior change requests.
Right. Instead of criticizing what your partner does wrong, you make specific, positive requests for what you'd like them to do, and you connect it to your deeper need.
Can you give me an example of how that works?
Instead of, "You never listen to me, pet," you might say, "When you put down your phone and make eye contact while I'm talking, I feel valued and connected to you. Would you be willing to do that when I need to share something important?"
That's much more actionable than a general complaint.
And it explains why the behavior matters to you. Hendrix emphasizes that we're more likely to change when we understand how our behavior affects someone we love.
What if your partner refuses your request?
That's information. Hendrix would say you need to dialogue about what makes that request difficult for them. Maybe there's a competing need or a trigger you don't understand.
He also talks about something called the stretch. What does that mean?
Stretch is when you give your partner something that doesn't come naturally to you but meets their needs. It's how you recover your lost self by developing traits that were discouraged in childhood.
So if you were forced to be overly serious as a child, stretching might mean being more playful with your partner?
Exactly. And if your partner was forced to be the responsible one, they might stretch by being more spontaneous. You're literally growing into wholeness through the relationship.
But what if the stretch feels impossible or goes against your core values?
Hendrix distinguishes between stretching and self-betrayal. You're not asked to violate your values, but to expand your range of responses. It should feel challenging, but growth-producing, not soul-crushing.
Let's talk about some realistic scenarios. How would this work if one partner wants more social time and the other is more introverted?
The extroverted partner might request specific social activities and explain how connection with others helps them feel energized and happy. The introverted partner would mirror, validate, and empathize with that need.
And then what? The introvert forces themselves to become social?
Not exactly. They might stretch by agreeing to one social event per week, while the extroverted partner stretches by accepting quiet time at home. Both partners grow.
What about more serious issues, like different approaches to money or parenting?
The process is the same, but these deeper differences often connect to childhood wounds about security or control. The dialogue helps you understand what's driving your positions, not just negotiate a compromise.
Can you walk through a money conflict using this approach?
Let's say one partner wants to save aggressively and the other wants to enjoy money now. Instead of arguing about budgets, you dialogue about what money represents to each of you.
How might those deeper needs sound?
The saver might share, "When we don't have a substantial emergency fund, I feel terrified and unsafe, like we could lose everything." The spender might say, "When we can't enjoy the money we earn, I feel deprived and like life is passing us by."
So you're addressing the emotional needs underneath the financial disagreement?
Right. Once you understand that one partner needs security and the other needs enjoyment, you can find ways to meet both needs instead of just fighting about spending limits.
What would behavior change requests look like in that scenario?
The security-focused partner might request, "Would you be willing to agree on a monthly fun money amount after we've put something in savings?" It would help me feel secure, knowing we're building a foundation. The enjoyment-focused partner might request regular date nights or small purchases that don't require discussion.
If someone could only implement one thing from this book, what should it be?
Start mirroring your partner's words before responding with your own perspective. Just that simple practice can transform how conflicts unfold.
Even without the validation and empathy steps?
Even just mirroring slows down the reactive cycle. Most relationship damage happens when we respond to what we think our partner said rather than what they actually said.
Let's be honest about this book's limitations. Where does Hendricks overpromise or oversimplify?
The biggest criticism I have is that he sometimes makes it sound like any relationship can be healed with enough dialogue and stretching. Some relationships involve abuse, addiction, or fundamental incompatibilities that can't be dialogued away.
The book doesn't really address when to leave a relationship, does it?
Not directly. Hendricks is so focused on the growth potential in difficult relationships that he doesn't adequately address toxic situations or relationships that have simply run their course.
What about couples where one person is willing to do this work and the other isn't?
That's a huge limitation. The process really requires both partners to participate. Hendricks doesn't offer much guidance for the person whose partner refuses to engage.
Are there other approaches that complement or improve on his work?
Emotionally Focused Therapy by Sue Johnson builds on similar ideas but focuses more on attachment patterns. John Gottman's research provides more specific tools for day-to-day relationship maintenance.
What does this book do brilliantly that those approaches don't?
Hendricks connects current relationship patterns to childhood wounds in a way that's both psychologically sophisticated and practically useful. He helps you understand not just what to do, but why you're struggling in the first place.
The book also seems unusually honest about how difficult real intimacy is.
Absolutely. He doesn't promise that love should be easy or that the right person won't trigger you. He reframes conflict as information and growth opportunity rather than relationship failure.
How has this book influenced the broader field of couples therapy?
Imago therapy is now practiced worldwide, and many of Hendricks's insights about unconscious partner choice and childhood wounds have become mainstream in couples therapy.
What about its influence on popular culture?
You see echoes of his ideas everywhere. The concept that we're attracted to people who challenge us to grow, that conflict can be productive, that understanding your partner's childhood helps explain their behavior.
Has the book faced any significant criticism over the years?
Some critics argue that his theories about unconscious partner choice aren't scientifically proven. Others worry that focusing so much on childhood wounds can excuse bad behavior in the present.
Those seem like valid concerns.
They are. I think the book works best when you take the practical tools seriously, but hold the theoretical framework more lightly. The dialogue process works regardless of whether you buy into the Imago theory.
As we wrap up, what's the single most important insight from this book?
That your partner's most annoying behaviors are often connected to their deepest wounds. When you can respond to their pain with curiosity instead of defensiveness, everything changes.
And the most practical takeaway?
Before you respond to your partner's complaint or criticism, repeat back what you heard them say and ask if you got it right. That one practice can prevent most relationship damage.
Michael, thank you for helping us understand how this book can actually transform relationships, rather than just improve them.
Thanks, Sarah. The key insight is that intimate relationships aren't just about finding the right person. They're about becoming the person capable of real love.